Good morning. It's time for the Estate and Medicaid Planning Hour with the Herzog Law Firm.
Will you still need me? Will you still feed me when I'm 64?
And good morning. This is Dave Kabikian.
And good morning. This is J. Marie Schaefer.
Who's on a two-second delay, apparently. Good morning, Jay Marie, and welcome, everyone, to the Herzog Estate and Medicaid Planning Hour. We're here every weekend talking to you about estate planning. We have offices in Albany, Kingston, Saratoga Springs, and Clifton Park, and we do this. We do estate planning. We do trusts and wills, powers of attorney, Medicaid applications, all sorts of interesting stuff. I wouldn't call it good stuff because not all of it's very good, but J. Marie, how you doing? Happy October.
I am doing well. Fall is really here in full force, right?
It is. Last weekend was so fantastic, and now it's fall. Now it's back to normal.
That's
you know, I did forget, J. Marie, to tell everyone that if they want to call in with a question, and we would love to get your questions, the number is 518-476-5900, and absent questions, we're going to talk about, you know, news and things going on with our clients, but we always like to get answers to people who have immediate questions on a Saturday morning.
That's right. We had good webinars this week, and I know there are people who didn't get enough information at the webinar, so I always encourage them to listen to our shows for more information. A webinar is a great experience, but sometimes it's hard to put all the information out there in the short time that we have.
So I'm looking at the calendar, J. Marie. So the two webinars this past week were Medicaid and Estate Planning Myths, and then there was one on Aging in Place. Which one did you do?
I did Aging in Place.
And you always do Aging in Place. Do you feel like it's some sort of age thing? What do you think?
You think I know about it?
I'm just wondering. I'm curious.
I don't know who assigns me to that all the time.
Well, I wouldn't blame people for having lots of questions about aging in place, because that topic's been, you know, other than obviously COVID that we've been dealing with, the other huge thing in our lives as estate planning attorneys has been aging in place. So what's going on?
Yeah, so aging in place, I mean, yes, there's a lot to cover, because we talk about legal papers you need to have in place. Kim talks about resources there are in the community. And then we talk about financial and how to pay for it. And then, if we can squeeze it in, there's been big changes in the law in community Medicaid recently. So that's something we also tried to cover in that short period of time.
So the aging in place in general, it's for people to get some care, some long-term care in the comfort of their home or their apartment, or even if they're living with one of their kids, to get care at their kid's house. And it's through a program called Community Medicaid. And historically, J. Marie, it would be quite easy to qualify for the program, because there wasn't a look-back period. Whenever people hear about long-term care and Medicaid, they always instinctively think about five-year look-back periods. No, it's too late. I didn't do anything in advance. But for this program, historically, there's been no look-back period. So you meet with Jane Marie, you say, hey, I never did any planning. I got a bunch of money, and I need care. And what would you do, Jane Marie? You'd button that up pretty quickly, right?
Yeah, it would be a very easy fix. We could transfer assets to a trust to protect the assets. And then right away, basically the following month, you could apply for Medicaid. So there is no, well, there was no look back period, right?
Yeah, we gotta get used to that past tense.
So I know, that's hard to say, right?
What's the change?
So October 1st was the change. So they changed the law, and now there will be a 2.5 year look back period on community Medicaid, and keeping the 5 year look back on nursing home Medicaid. So that means you would have had to do your planning 2.5 years ahead of time to be able to apply for community Medicaid.
Right. Now, it looks like the way they're going to implement this look-back period isn't going to kind of unduly penalize people that apply, you know, you apply next month. Are we really going back to 2018? Probably not, right? All the guidance that we've received is that they're just going to look back to see what the status was on October 1st. But every month we go, it'll be one more month of a look back, again, going all the way back to basically 2 days ago. And so, it was quite busy in the office. It kind of always is. But in particular, because we had existing clients who were rushing to put more things into their existing trust to try to fund it a little better prior to the October 1st date. We had new clients who said, can you do a trust for me? Sure. And then they say, what time should I come tomorrow to sign it? We're like, whoa. It doesn't happen that fast. But we had a bunch of new clients in that. And then we also had a number of clients, new and old, where they actually need the services and they wanted to apply before these rules would be put into place. And, there's everything's kind of still in flux because of COVID and some other, New York does this sometimes. They come up with a budget and they say, okay, here's the new rule. And then the implementation of the rule and all the details aren't always available. So they're still kind of working this out. So I don't know how you feel about Jay Marie. My rule of thumb for people is, all things being equal, the earlier you do things, the better. And even though it's October 3rd, it's October 3rd, right? Yeah. Even though it's October 3rd, if you want to set up a trust, because that's October 3rd is better than November 1st, right?
True.
It's better than December 1st. And we kind of feel like, they may slow roll the implementation of this. So if you need to apply for this home care, let's do it. If you need a trust, let's do it. If you got one and you need to put more in, give us a call.
That's right. I think we may have some breathing room, although it's not formal in that they are not going to look back or apply the look back period until January 1st.
Yeah,
and there's a possibility they could push that out even further. But like you said, we can't rely on that. We have to go with the October 1st date.
Yeah, that's kind of like the guarantee, is that the people that got in before October 1st, we could tell you you're in really good shape. People who waited or weren't able to get in time, let me say this, Jamie, because I got a lot of questions from existing clients and phone consults and so on. I'm sure you got the same, where it was a phone call with someone, one of our clients. They saw one of the webinars, right? And they heard about this change, and they think they need to create something. They need to file for Medicaid, or their trust that they did a number of years ago no longer is okay because of this change. Nothing could be farther from the truth. The change in the law really only impacts people who need to apply for help, need to apply for care. If you're perfectly healthy and you're going to be perfectly healthy and not have any long-term care needs for a number of years, this change made no difference in your life.
That's right. And in fact, many of our clients have had these trusts in existence for a long time. Even more than 2.5 years, more than 5 years. So they're sitting in a pretty good position where they don't need care, but they know in the future if they need care, whatever they have in the trust is already protected. So that's a nice place to be in.
We'd love to have our first caller at 518-476-5900. Jay Marie, I've had a couple recent clients. I feel like we always have a couple recent clients like this. They did have the trust for a really long time, like you said. But, seven out of 10 times, let's say, the only thing in that trust that they created in 2004 is their house. And they never actually put more in it. When you meet with someone and they say, well, what am I putting in this trust and what don't I put in? What's your advice? What's your rule of thumb? How do you advise them?
So generally, I always recommend a house, right? I think that's the most common thing to put in the trust. And the reason is because you're not losing control. You have the life use in the house. You're still living there. You're still paying the taxes. So that's an easy one. In terms of the money or investments that you have, it's always a discussion of how much you feel comfortable parting ways with, putting it into but you're not really parting ways with it. So let me explain that. So you can put some money in the trust that you're not using currently. But if something changes in the future and you have an emergency come up and you need that money, you can do a partial revocation of the trust. And you just need to get all your beneficiaries to sign off on that. So that's one way that you can access the money in the trust. So it is an individual choice as to how much money you do put in the trust. And sometimes you don't do it right away, right? Sometimes you don't do it when you first set up the trust because you're newly retired and you want to travel and spend money. But then maybe you come back in a couple years or 10 years when you're 75. And now you're slowing down a bit and now you're ready to put some more money in the trust. So I've seen
right.
it done in
stages. So I'm a little more aggressive, I think, Jaymarie, in my recommendations, and it's just because we do it so much, so we're so used to the idea of always being able to get to your money if you want it. You could always withdraw money if you want it. It's just not you by yourself doing it. It's just there's one extra layer of complexity, and that throws people off initially because they say, well, you know, I liked life when I just had stuff in my own name. That was pretty easy. That's, yeah, no doubt. It is easier to not do a trust. The only problem is that one day if we have long-term care needs and we're looking to not spend our own money on those needs, we're going to turn to Medicaid, and Medicaid's going to say, hey, what can you get out of the bank by yourself, right? What can you touch right now by yourself? And so the status quo doesn't actually work for most people. You have money in the bank. You have CDs. You have savings bonds. You have brokerage accounts, cash value and life insurance. Hell, you could sell your house if I'm offering the right price, and you could do all of these things. You could access all this money. You could sell your house with just your signature right now. And that's what Medicaid kind of grasps, because they say, well, if you can touch it, then you can touch it to pay for your nursing home. Why are you asking us to cover it? So they kind of don't look at the things, they don't look at those assets that you by yourself can't access. And when we create this particular kind of trust, this Medicaid trust, we involve someone called a trustee who is not you, it cannot be you, but it's your kid or it's your brother or your family friend, whoever. But the most important fact of it, Jaymarie, is that they work for you. They're an employee. They're actually an employee that you don't have to pay. It's a free internship. Right, you could fire them and replace them whenever you want to, but they happen to be your extra signature to get to the money whenever you want it. So it takes some people some time to understand that, and they say, whoa, irrevocable. I know what that word means. I don't like it, right? I can't get to it. I can't undo it. But they're actually wrong because it's just teeny tiny bit irrevocable, just in terms of the fact that you by yourself can't pull your own money out, as you mentioned. It's you plus people you always control. And, oh, by the way, they usually are the people who are going to be beneficiaries of your whole estate plan anyway. So everyone's on the same team. Let's save a boatload of money. So it's not as controversial as people may think. So because I feel that way, and I think it's pretty easy to get to your money, I usually tell people, what does your life cost for the next 6 months, right? All your expenses and vacations and stuff like that, that amount, leave that outside the trust. And you know what? You do have income. You do have retirement income. You know, put everything else in the trust. And remember, you could always pull it out if we need to. But, you know, the more you can protect, the better. What could I say?
Yep, that's true. But the other thing is, I think I felt more comfortable saying if you left some money out of the trust and then suddenly you needed care, well, we can always get you home care, right? We could put your money in the trust and apply for home care.
Yes. That was always, that's how it used to be.
That's how it used to be. Right.
Jaymarie and David?
Yeah.
We have our first caller this morning.
Okay.
We have Sharon from Clifton Park.
Hey, Sharon.
Good morning.
Good morning. What's going on?
First of all, let me say that my hearing isn't the best, so I'm sorry if I have to ask you to repeat. These are simple questions, I think. First of all, do I understand correctly? I have a irrevocable trust that just my house is in. I've had it for about 6 years. Am I correct in understanding that if now I wanted to put money, I can put it into that same trust?
Yes, you always could put money into the trust. So, and now we're kind of putting a bigger emphasis on people doing that. There's no cost to doing that. It's just some paperwork that you do with, you know, wherever you're holding your money. But because, as Jane Marie mentioned, there's less room for error now, because if we start to have long-term care needs, we can't just flip the switch and automatically qualify for home care. There's now a look back. We want people to be a little more aggressive in what they put into the trust.
Right. So I can, like, take an account that exists and put it into the trust starting at, obviously, year zero.
Yes.
And, okay. Can I do it so that the interest doesn't go into the trust?
Yeah, Jamie, you want to take this?
Oh, yeah, sure. Yep, you can. So the trust says
I'm thinking of that just for paperwork purposes, because we all know interest doesn't exist.
Right, there is no interest.
Right. So I don't want to have extra paperwork and stuff for, you know, $1.50 or something.
That's right. But let's assume we're in a world where the interest rates are back up again, right? You could take the income from the trust, and the trust says you're entitled to that. And so you could even set it up so the interest goes right to your checking account.
Okay. Yeah. All right. And then the next question would be, if at a later date I wanted to put more money, would I need to do a whole separate bank account from the initial one that I put in to keep records straight?
So
putting more money in.
That's a very good question, and I think the last couple words you said are the most important to keep, to make things a little easier in terms of,
right,
of measuring things.
Paperwork. Yeah.
So no one actually cares about when you put your money into the trust at all, or when you retitled things, unless and until we're actually applying for Medicaid for you.
Right.
So.
Right.
And it, you know, when we do apply, and there's going to be a 2.5-year look back period for home care, 5 years for nursing homes, like, more likely than not, you will engage an attorney to help with that, or your family members would. And, you know, we have 3 unbelievable paralegals that make us look extremely good that do that. And what part of what they do is they will go through all the statements for every single account you have now and have had in the last 5 years, and they will reconcile all of it. Certainly, if this account started in 2020 and the next time you put in money, it's a separate account that was, you know, was put in 2022, that obviously makes the math real easy, but you don't have to do it. That may be something
I don't have
you choose to
do. Yeah, I'm more concerned with any paperwork I might have to do year to year with taxes or something. So,
well, the year to year is pretty easy because you know, you're the income beneficiary of the trust. The trust doesn't pay taxes. Everything passes through to you, and at the end of the year, you get a 1099 INT or for dividends, whatever it happens to be, and you just report it on your taxes. It's pretty straightforward.
Oh, okay. There isn't a separate form and stuff.
There's a separate form, but the trust doesn't pay taxes, so filing your own taxes is really easy.
I'm worried about the paperwork.
Yeah, it's pretty easy.
Okay. And finally, if I may, can you put a life insurance policy into the trust?
Yes, you can, especially if it's a life insurance policy that's a whole life or a universal and it has cash value. Yeah, that's the type that you want to put in, because Medicaid would count that cash value as money. So what you can do is you ask for a change of ownership form on your life insurance, and that just transfers the ownership of the life insurance into your trust.
Okay. Great. Well, I thank you very much. I think you've answered my questions for now. And
very good.
Love your show.
Thanks for the call.
Lots.
Okay, good.
Have a good morning.
You too.
Bye-bye.
Bye. So, Jamie, did you see what she did there? She said she has a question. It was 4 questions. She got 4 questions for the price of 1. That's savvy right there.
That is very smart.
I don't know how, Ben, you let that through. 4 questions. Unbelievable.
Because if I turned her down, then you guys would be gone. So it's probably not a good idea. But thank you.
You could be our second caller by calling that same number, 518-477-6599.
And we may have one in just a second as soon as I answer the phone, so don't talk about anything really hard.
Okay, well, I'll repeat the number then, 518-476-5900. And, Jamarie, those questions, we love those questions. Those are, you know, we don't want you to just do a trust and not know why you did it or not know how it works or how to use it in the future. That's it, right? We want you to know every little detail and kind of strategize with us to come up with the best possible plan that's not kind of ongoing, right? It changes from time to time.
That's right. Your plan is going to change, and you're going to have questions, so we do want you to keep in touch with us, right? We're always happy to answer a question for you or meet with you to look over your documents.
Or you could call into the show, like Beth from Albany just did.
Hey, Beth. How's it going?
Hi, it's good. Thank you for taking my call.
What's up?
We recently put our mother's switched into an irrevocable trust for, you know, some of the things that you're talking about. I have a question about, she does yearly donations and she gets a tax write-off for these. I was just wondering if you could speak on that. Should we keep doing this? Is this something that could be looked at and that she has assets to do this? Should we keep doing this? It does give her a tax write-off.
Jamarie?
Sure. So first of all, I mean, one threshold is, are the donations over $2,000 or under $2,000?
Did you say over 2,000 or under? Over 2,000, but over like 5,000.
Okay. So that's an issue because Medicaid does look at all transfers over $2,000. And then this is the question. This question always bothers me because if you donate to charity, Medicaid does penalize you for that. They consider that a gift, and they can penalize you for that. But in this case, we would probably try to argue our exception that it's a gift other than planning for Medicaid. I mean, that's an exception where you've always made these gifts. You weren't doing it to try and make yourself eligible for Medicaid. And I know David has argued this at fair hearing, and this is one of the exceptions you would want to try and use to explain these gifts.
Yeah, so Medicaid can question, right? They are going to look, when we talk about what is this look back period, they're looking back to see what large transactions, what large sums of money were removed from the applicant's assets. So they typically will look for things more than $2,000, although they have the right to look at things under $2,000. And, you know, they want explanations. Okay, this $5,000, this was for a furnace. Okay, right, here's a copy of the check. When it's money that goes without consideration, so it's a gift, whether it's a family member or charity, then it gets a little more complicated. Okay, so if she was healthy and has been donating money, all of a sudden some awful thing happens, a stroke, something like that, and now she's in a nursing home, well, the things that she did 4 years ago, right, that shouldn't be held against her. She was healthy 4 years ago. So that's an example of one of the exceptions. The one that I think would sound the best for her is that it sounds like she's always been doing this. She's always been giving money. And there's an exception for gifts that have been ongoing for a period of time that extend beyond the five-year look-back period. And that certainly can work. Now, I had fact patterns before, and I've lost them. I'm happy to admit I lost them. But the fact patterns were where each kid's getting $2,000 a year from mom. $2,000. Now all of a sudden, mom's not feeling well. It's $10,000, $15,000, $15,000 each year. And that's where they'll say, wait a minute. You kept it at $2,000, there would be this whole pattern. But if you're elevating the gifts, who's to say you're not doing it for Medicaid purposes? I love the fact that she's giving money to charities and good causes, though. So I would say for her to keep doing it, live her life, not only worry about, you know, don't just worry about Medicaid, but if she could keep it in the same amounts, it helps ensure with good record keeping that it's not going to be a problem.
Okay. So even though it's over the 2000, just as long as we keep the pattern, that you know, the same pattern as far as her
I mean, it could be a fight. There's no guarantee. Jamie's 1,000% correct. They will target those transactions. And a lot of times what we do, because, you know, our paralegals also all happen to previously be reviewers of applications, is we'll kind of set up Medicaid and explain to them, all right, here's a, you know, two phone books worth of documents, but here's a schedule, and these are transfers we're pointing out to you that are part of a pattern. We don't anticipate a problem. Here you go. Here's all the backup. So we kind of get in front of it to kind of explain it to them, and that typically will work for us.
Okay. All right. That's,
tell her to keep
going forward. Okay. All right. Thank you so much for taking my call and answering my question.
Thank you.
I always thought that that was a bad rule, and there should be an exception for charities. I mean, but that's...
I know. It's you're right, or at least some higher cap for transactions that go to charities. I agree. Yeah. You know, if you're filling out your taxes, you know, you can manipulate your tax bill by giving more to charities in a given year, right? Mm-hmm. You should. It's similar concept. You should be able to manipulate the Medicaid exposure by giving to real good causes. Why not? I mean, I guess I suppose, you know, there are different kinds of 501c3 charities, and maybe someone will think of a way to take advantage of such a rule, but I don't know.
Right. I don't know. I think if you are giving to charity, it's a good thing that you're doing, and you're not really benefiting from that, right? So...
Yeah, and I think, Jamie, just on a bigger point, that our bottom line isn't we have to save every dollar. Our goal is we want everyone to live their lives and enjoy and do whatever it is that they want to do and not just be worried about this potential, you know, thing at the end of life or towards the end of life. You know, it's all right if not every dollar is saved. It's all right explaining to Medicaid and even losing an argument because, you know what, you do want to see your kids receive some money during your life. You do want to give money to charity so you could see the benefit of it, right? So there's more that goes into it.
That's right. And like you said, you do have to just live your life and do what you want to do, not always think about Medicaid.
So
we think about Medicaid all the time, don't we?
Unfortunately, it's weird when I watch like TV programs. Well, first of all, right now when I watch anything on TV, I'm like, oh my God, I can't believe there's people in a restaurant in the background of that scene, or that
That's
there's
right.
people in the stands at the sporting event. It's different.
It's coming up to 8:30, so we are going to take our break, and we do have a caller on the other side. Jim in Greenwich is hanging on, so we'll take our break here. We'll be right back with the second half of the Herzog Law Firm's Estate Medicaid Planning Hour coming up right after this.
You've been listening to the Estate and Medicaid Planning Hour with the Herzog Law Firm.
Join us every week to learn more about protecting the assets you've worked hard for,
options available for Medicaid planning, and more.
With offices located in Corporate Woods in Albany,
West Harrison Street in Saratoga Springs,
Executive Woods in Clifton Park,
and Flatbush Road in Kingston.
Our attorneys are here to help you.
If you'd like to schedule an appointment to speak with David,
Jane Marie Harry, or Debbie,
please call us during normal business hours, Monday through Friday, 9 a.m. to 5 p.m.
To contact us at our Albany office, call 518-465-7581.
Our Saratoga Springs office at 518-581-8131.
Our Clifton Park office at 518-952-4010.
And our Kingston office at 845-338-6405.
Let the Herzog Law Firm help you navigate a plan that works for you and your family. Now back to the Estate and Medicaid Planning Hour with the Herzog Law Firm.
And welcome back. This is Dave Kabikian.
And this is Jane Marie Schaefer.
Jane Marie and I are two of the attorneys at Herzog Law Firm. We're here every weekend talking estate and Medicaid planning offices, Albany, Kingston, Saratoga, Clifton Park. We don't have an office in Greenwich, where Jim is, but Jim, we help you. What's going on?
Yes, I am a customer of Herzog. I have an irrevocable trust. And my question has to do with the interest that is generated by the trust. I understand that it's not taxable. However, what happens if I would transfer the interest, say, to a brokerage account and then use that money to pay, say, property or school tax? What happens to the tax status under those conditions?
So, Jim, let me just say the first part of it, and then we'll go to the second part. So interest, any income earned that from assets that are in the trust are taxable. They're taxable to you, the individual. The trust won't pay taxes on it, but you will. So let me give you an example. And instead of, you put a CD into the trust, or you put a stock in the trust. You put AT&T stock into your trust. There's going to be a 4% dividend at, you know, at each year. You can choose to not take it and kind of reinvest it in the trust like a lot of people do, or you can choose to actually have that income be removed and put in your pocket. But regardless of what you do, at the end of that year, you're going to get a piece of paper that says you got to report these dividends, this interest, on your tax return. So it is taxable. It's just that the trust doesn't pay taxes. Okay?
I got you.
Does that make sense? Okay.
Yes.
So what was the second part of your question?
Well, I think it's been answered. If I transferred that money from the trust, the interest now, to a brokerage account and then onto a checking account so that I could pay school taxes and property taxes, what's the tax status for that? You've answered that question.
Right. So you could just take that money out immediately from the trust because it's income. And even if it was not income, if it wasn't dividends and interest and you just wanted to pull money out of the trust, there's that, you know, the partial revocation, that mechanism to pull money out whenever you feel like it. You could always do that, right? But what you were saying is, well, I get that interest, and then I funnel it through this other account and this account. You don't have to do all of that transfers if you don't want to.
Yeah, well, I do it for paperwork purposes.
Okay.
Okay.
So while we have you on the phone, how do you like your trust? How often do you think about it? I bet not that often.
Well, I think about it every Saturday morning when I listen to you guys.
Oh, what a great answer, Jean Marie.
That is a great answer.
Jim, we'll pay you after the show. Thanks so much for the call.
Do you need an address?
we have your address on file.
Okay. Have a good day, guys.
You too.
Okay, good day. Well, that is good. That is someone who is actively thinking and working with his trust. That's what we like.
And yeah, absolutely. For most people, they don't even, like, you know, it's like, oh my God, I don't know who I want to use as my trustee. It's going to be so much work. It really isn't. Right. At the beginning, they sign a couple things. At the end, unfortunately, they sign a couple things. In between, right. not that much going on.
There isn't much for the trustee to do, no. So once they sign those initial papers, they're probably not going to do anything again for many years. So it's not really a burden to ask someone. We always get in these discussions, with my clients, about who should be the trustee and who should be the executor. And people are afraid of offending one child by picking another child. I'm sure that must happen to you as well, David.
Yeah, I don't think they understand that maybe one of the worst jobs in the world is to be executor, and it for the most part, and trustee for the most part, especially when it's family members, they might not even take commissions. They're entitled to commissions if they're an executor, but a lot of times they don't even do it, and you're just basically running around and making sure that mom and dad's plan happened. You mentioned some webinars earlier, Jane Marie. We do have a whole bunch coming up on these Wednesdays that are coming up. This next week, October 7th, at 10 a.m., we'll have a webinar called Wills versus Trust, one of our more popular seminars turned webinar now. And then at 2 p.m., a new riser is a Medicare versus Medicaid. webinar. It's really more about Medicare. I've done it a couple times, and I'm not really saying too much about Medicaid just because 1 hour is not nearly enough time to cover these two topics. But it is important. There are important dates around the calendar that are important for those who are receiving Medicare. And if you're not yet receiving Medicare and you're going to be receiving it soon, it's super important to talk to a professional. We're not one of those, by the way, a professional about Medicare. You know, the purpose of the webinar is just to tell you about some of the differences between that program and Medicaid, because so many times people get confused. The following week on the 14th, Wednesday the 14th, at 10 a.m., it's How to Plan Your Estate, followed by Jane Marie's favorite at 2 p.m., Aging in Place. And then following week, we actually, it's our webinar week, so 1 week every single month we do nothing but 2 p.m. seminars each and every day, and we have a whole schedule up on our website at www.herzoglaw.com. If you want a seat at, I guess, the comfort of your own couch to one of the webinars, all you got to do is call us. You could also go to our website and click register online on the link for the webinars on our website. You can call our office at 518-465-7581. You can email us, J. Marie, at info@herzoglaw.com.
David, J. Marie?
Yeah.
We have another caller. We have Stephen from Schenectady.
Good morning.
Good morning, Stephen.
Good morning. Great show as always, Dave. I always enjoy listening to you guys.
Oh, thanks.
And this might be a familiar voice to you, Dave, but got a question about trusts, because I have a number of clients who might be suitable for trusts, but they tell me, well, if I get a New York trust, but I'm moving to Florida or Alabama in years hence, you know, what good's it going to do then?
Well, Jay-Marie, take this in. Steve, before you go, let me just say we were just talking about how important it is to Medicare plan as you're getting close to 65. Steve from Schenectady is one of the guys you should be talking to. So if you do want Steve's contact info, we're happy to provide it to you after the show, or you could email us. So thanks for the call, Steve. So, Jay-Marie, what say you? I want to move out of New York. Should I do a New York trust now, or what do I do?
You should definitely do a New York trust. The rules on the Medicaid planning and protecting your assets are federal rules. So if you put your assets in a trust, it's going to protect your assets whatever state you move to. And so that's a good place to start. And if you're living here, you're a resident here. And I think New York has one of the better trust statutes. So I think even it's a good idea to be governed under New York trust law as opposed to other states. So there's certainly advantages to doing it, because you want to start on that look back period, right? So you don't want to wait, even if you're only moving in a year or two, that's cutting down 2 years into your look back period. So you would want to start the trust to get started on that look back period.
Right. So let me ask you, Jane Marie. So I create a New York trust. You live in Massachusetts. You create a Massachusetts trust. The laws in Massachusetts are pretty different than New York. I can get away with more because of New York law than you can because of Massachusetts law, right?
Well, right. For things outside the trust, so the big change is in Massachusetts, retirement plans are not exempt as they are in New York. So your IRAs are not protected. So there are differences like that in New York law. But if I put my house in the trust here, it's going to be protected.
Right, and I'm sorry, go ahead, Jamie.
No, I was just saying, just like it would be in New York, if I put money in a trust here, it would be protected.
And what I understand, you know, the statute in New York that basically says even though this thing's irrevocable, we can blow it up whenever we feel like it or pull money out whenever we feel like it, just with the signatures of interested parties. I don't believe that's the same in Massachusetts, right?
Yeah, no, that's true. That's specific to New York. So that's another reason why I say New York law is better. So if you're in New York, you can say New York law applies to this trust. And then even if you move later on, that doesn't change what law applies to the trust. Because it's by what the trust document says.
I tell people that if, you know, the saying for New York, if you can make it here, you can make it anywhere. We have some pretty tough Medicaid laws, and the trust and the concept of the trust and how it protects things, that carries everywhere. I don't care where you move. Jamie's spot on. We don't want to, you know, you're going to move soon. Well, how soon is soon? Is it soon in 3 months? Well, then wait. Right? And you could do something in the new state, perhaps. If soon as sometime next year we're thinking of listing the house, get that thing done now. Put the house in now, because one day you sell it, well, the proceeds will continue to be protected. At least you're piggybacking on whatever amount of time has already accrued. So moving out of state shouldn't be, it actually isn't a big difference maker. Where I think there's the biggest difference for moving out of state, Jamie, is if someone says they're thinking of long-term care insurance, as an example, and they have something called a New York State Partnership Plan. Well, you better be getting your long-term care in New York for that plan to help you. We won't get into it, but there are some very state-specific things. Thankfully, this trust isn't one of them.
That's right.
All right, great answer. Thanks.
Thanks. Another
Jamie, you were about to say something about what I said. You were about to agree with me 1,000% and tell me it was the best answer you ever heard. So go ahead.
No, Jim,
I interrupted
Jim,
you.
Jim actually was hanging up on you. That's actually what he was doing. So.
Oh, no, that was Steve, by the way, Ben. That was Steve.
And he's done with you. Okay. So. Actually, we have another caller coming in, so we'll find out who that is.
Oh, okay.
Yes, everything you say is 100% correct, David.
Jamie, thank you so much. Let me know where to send a check.
Yeah, the check, leave it on my desk there.
But it was a good question by Steve. That's a commonly asked question, because we have a lot of clients that end up moving down to South Carolina or moving down to Florida or even Arizona. It's important to know whether do you have to do a new trust? No.
No.
How about a new power of attorney, though? You probably will do a new power of attorney and healthcare proxy.
Yeah, I usually suggest that. I mean, our New York one is legal in any 50 of the 50 states, but you're going to want the local one because the banks or the doctors are going to be more used to their forms than the New York forms.
Right.
And we do have a caller. We have Frank from Waterville Eat.
Good morning,
Frank.
Good morning. Hi. I have a question about community Medicaid, because you don't hear a lot about it. And I know from listening to you guys in the past, it sounds like a great program. Anyway, my question is that my wife and I are both disabled, both blind, and we're getting to the point where we need somebody to come in and help us with some light cleaning and maybe some transportation to medical appointments.
Mm-hmm.
A little bit of, not just transportation to the door of the appointments. What I mean is like somebody to go in the office and make sure we understand what the doctor's telling us. Would community Medicaid pay for that?
Yes. So those things that you're referencing are long-term care types of things. People would be surprised at what the community Medicaid program can cover, because it's not just help with an actual activity of daily living like bathing and toileting and transporting. It's actually can include all those other types of things. Now, someone who's got task-based needs. I need help crossing the street. I need help with my shopping. I need help with certain things in my day. You may not get as many hours of care as someone who has dementia, who needs an ongoing level of help, but you both would actually be good candidates for it. Now, how many hours would you get of help? I don't know. Right, we could have Kim talk to you, and she could ballpark it, but really, we won't know until after we've qualified you, applied for you, you've been approved, and then Medicaid has a process of evaluating you to tell you how many hours. So there may be some other programs out there in the community. Kim Hance from our office does a really great job of being informed on all those other programs as well. So there may be something that's not community Medicaid that can help you. if the plan is...
Yeah, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, if the plan is, you know, that we're going to keep getting older, which is a very good plan in my mind, even if you don't use a lot of the community Medicaid program now, it may be a good idea for you guys to be approved and in the system, even with a teeny tiny amount of care, so that way when there's more care that may be needed in the future, it'll be that much easier to qualify. We won't have to worry about look-back periods because you're already in.
Well, that's sort of where I know it's sort of, I'd say, in a slippery slope, but, like, we're at the top of it, just starting to head down because we've been, both of us have been blind for around 20 years, if not longer. So we do have, we do know about the other services, and the problem is we need something that helps a little bit more than what the other services do now, and we don't need, I mean, it's getting to a point where we need a little more intensive mm-hmm. services, which some of which we've been paying for, but now we're not. We're getting in a position where it's getting harder to do that. We're married, of course. Now, the big stumbling block for us has been Medicaid claims. Oh, well, you've got too much assets, and all we have is just Social Security, our two Social Securities, and a real small bank account. Mm-hmm. And they claim, oh, you can't qualify for food stamps or any of that because you have too much money.
Right.
And we don't want to get divorced. So does that just throw us out of the mix for how?
I think that's where you come in and meet with Jamery or have a phone call with her where she could walk you through exactly how we can get you qualified for these different services. Those trusts that we've been talking about, that's a way to create essentially immediate eligibility. The problem right now is that the rules are changing, as Jamery mentioned. But, you know, we could look at your facts and formulate a plan that can help you qualify. We're not going to recommend anyone get divorced just yet, okay? I think there are things we could figure out.
I appreciate that, and I wasn't thinking that you would. It's just that mm-hmm. has sort of been not a stumbling block, but the first thing out of other people's mouths in our family and some mm-hmm. other places has been,
What I'd do is I'd... I'm sorry to cut you off. What I would do is I'd call our office, 518-465-7581, and what we could do is, whether it's Jamery, Debbie, Harry, myself, we'll walk through all the assets, all the, you know, all the income, the specific situation, and come up with a plan for you, okay?
Okay, hang on one second. Can you give me that number again? You went a little bit fast for me.
No problem. And thanks so much for the call. I'm gonna
Phone number again. Sorry.
Yep. 518-465-7581.
All right. Thank you very much. Have a great weekend, both of you.
You too.
Okay. Have a good weekend.
And we have another caller. We have Barb from Westmere.
Good morning, everyone. I have two quick questions for you. The first question is, I'm co-owner on my mom's two small bank accounts, and in the event she passes, will I be able to get to that money? Will the banks the accounts?
No, that's one of the benefits of being a co-owner on the bank account is that you can access the money directly. You won't have to wait or anything. You wouldn't have to wait for probate, for example. So that, you know, you can get to the money right away.
Okay. The other quick question I had was with life insurance. My mom recently changed her beneficiaries and submitted the paperwork to the insurance companies. Because I'm her power of attorney, the question was raised to me, can beneficiaries be challenged by members of her family, or is that a done deal for her, because she wanted to know if anybody could challenge her decision.
Well,
were you signing the change of beneficiary form as her power of attorney?
No.
Or was she signing it herself?
She did it separate and apart from me.
Oh. If she signed it herself, then I think it would be harder to challenge that, right? So she has capacity, I assume, and she knew what she was doing when she changed.
I advised her because she wanted to know what she had to do as far as filling out the forms, but mm-hmm. she signed the forms and she had it notarized by, an independent notary. I wasn't involved in the signing at all.
Mm-hmm. When you say you advised her, you weren't telling her, give me all your money. You were saying, this is how you fill out the form because you have an intent to already give me money, correct?
Right.
Okay.
Well,
yeah,
basically, what it was my brother's passed away. So she wanted to make sure that I got the money so I could pay for her insurance, pay her funeral expenses from her insurance money. So... Mm-hmm. And then she wanted to set up contingent beneficiaries also for her grandchildren, which is what she did. And I got the forms for her. You know, I filled them out for her, but she signed them. And in the presence of a notary, you know, it was notarized and she signed. And she has presence of mind.
Mm-hmm. That sounds pretty reasonable.
Should be all right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay,
it's
and that would
challenge something like
probate,
that.
Right?
That's correct. You'd avoid probate. So any asset that mom's got that has a beneficiary or, as Jamie mentioned, where there's joint ownership on a bank account, that asset's going to avoid probate.
Okay. All right. Thank you so much. Have a wonderful weekend.
Thanks for the call. A bunch of calls there, Jamie. What do you think?
I know. It's a lucky October, I guess, right?
So I don't know where to start from these questions, but you know, estate planning is more than wills and trusts. It's making sure there's the proper beneficiaries and designations on those different assets. Like our last caller was talking about, you know, at the basic level, even when you do have a trust, we know you're still going to have a bank account in your own name. We don't want to go through probate. You do a lot of it, right? I mean, like, it's part of the business. We'd prefer not to do it, right?
No, if we can avoid it, we can. I mean, of course we do it if we have to, but it's going to be much easier on your children or your beneficiaries if they don't have to go through probate. And we do try and help you get to that point by... that's why we ask for you to list all your assets, because there's different ways you can avoid probate, right? So we're going to make sure you have beneficiaries on all of your accounts. If you have an investment account or a bank account, we can either have you make a joint, or you can do a TOD, which is a transfer on death, and put a beneficiary on an investment account. So anything that's not in the trust, like David said, we're going to go through with you and make sure you have it going to someone.
What are your thoughts, Shimri, on where, so, you know, we have spidey senses, right? We hear certain things. We hear the voices of our clients or certain questions they ask, and we know the question they're really asking behind the question they're actually asking. Where there's a potential conflict between family members after mom passes, dad passes, I find that the more records and the more things that have been memorialized to show what someone's plan was, the better. Even when it comes to something like life insurance beneficiaries, and it may make sense for people who've made changes like that may seem controversial to actually consult with an attorney, if nothing else, so that the attorney has notes that indicate what their wishes were, rather than family members and speculating that, you know, so-and-so was talking in their ear and manipulated them.
Well, right, because I do a lot of the probates and I see the challenges to that. If someone is, you know, leaving out a child of their will, or if they're leaving things unequally, we will always ask the family members to leave the room and talk to that person individually, and we'll make notes. And that documents that person had capacity, they knew what they were doing, and that no one else was in the room when we spoke to them.
Right.
That's a good practice to do.
So what else? else is going on, Jeremy? I feel like we're about to be interrupted with another caller here, so I'm treading lightly.
Now we're getting close to the end of the show. Now I'm thinking you guys are good.
Oh, okay. Yeah. All right. Okay. So, Jeremy, you did. You did the webinar on aging in place. We talked a little bit about it, and it's obviously this area that's changing so much. What kind of advice are you giving to people? I mean, is it just, and I hate to sound so self-serving, but is it just, hey, come on in and we'll figure out all the details of your fact pattern, or how are you leading people?
I think if you want to protect your assets, I mean, go to a webinar first, right? Learn about long-term care planning. A lot of our clients do the webinars one or two times and then come in for a consultation with us. And I think that's a way of them getting some information. So then when they come in, we can go over their specific situation. So I always refer them back to our webinar schedule. Also, don't believe what you read on the internet is another thing.
It's pronounced internets. You have to pluralize it. The internets.
there's
definitely a lot of bad information. Yeah.
Bad information out there. That's right.
That and the old, this is what my neighbor told me, or I heard Medicare covers all of long-term care. Mm-hmm. Why did you hear that? How'd you hear that? Well, my neighbor fell, went to the hospital, came home, and it was all Medicare. I believe it. It's possible, right, Jamie? That's possible. We talk about it in our webinars. There is a route for that to happen. You're very lucky if it did.
Right, there is.
You got better really quickly.
It's not for a long time, though. It's only for a short period of time.
That's right. So be wary. The webinars are great. We do have them coming up the next two Wednesdays, as I mentioned. Next week, we're talking about at 2 p.m. Medicare versus Medicaid. And at 10 a.m., we're talking about wills versus trusts. And again, if you want to sit at one of those webinars, just sit down in your own home. But you could register by going to our website, herzoglaw.com, going to the seminar page, and then clicking on the webinar you want to register to. And quickly, most importantly, you can actually look at old webinars on our blog as well.
Yes, they're recorded. You can look at them. If the time we have is not good for you, you can watch them anytime at home.
Have a good weekend, Jamie.
You too. Bye-bye.
Okay, Jamie, thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Estate and Medicaid Planning Hour with the Herzog Law Firm. For more information on their services, please visit herzoglaw.com. If you'd like to speak with one of their attorneys, please contact the Albany office at 518-465-7581, the Saratoga office at 518-581-8131, or their Kingston office at 845-338-6405.